This program is brought to you by Resonance FM. If you like what you hear, please support our work by making a donation at resonancefm.com/donate.
Listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And hopefully I'm talking to Dan Wilson.
Hello.
No,
madam, we're on the same line. Please ring off. Hello.
Who's that?
Oh, yeah, is that William?
Oh, it's a party line, madam.
Is this another guest on the show?
Hello. No, madam, you ring off.
Who? Oh.
Hello, operator, hello.
I shan't be available on my own number today.
No, what? This is not Dr. Schluss.
Schluss?
08, yeah. Not 07.
I shall not be available on
hello.
My number. I shall
this
be going out in about
calling.
10 minutes.
Hello?
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 Yeah.
What? Madam, what would you like me to do?
What's going on?
What? Hello?
You're very rude.
Hello? Who's
my
this?
My fault. No, not in the least, not in the least.
Hello,
operator. They keep ringing me and tying up my line. Everyone is on the same line. Can't you tell that lady to hang up?
Hello?
Yes. Is this...
Sorry?
Hello?
Hello?
Is this person...
Is it you?
Hello?
Hello? Is that Dan?
Is it you?
I'm here. Who's this?
Okay.
I can barely hear you.
William?
You sound very far away, very far.
Hello?
What?
Hello?
Is there
this is dreadful. Everyone is on the same line. Call
somebody
me back.
On the
Yep.
Hello, call me back.
I can't call you back. Get off the line.
Call me back.
No.
Oh, madam, please ring off.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
But she can't hear me.
Here she is again. Hang on a sec.
Oh, at last it's you. Yes. It's very well. Hello. Yes.
Okay.
It was a real
effort. All right. Oh, it was a cross line, I think. I don't know.
But how can it be a cross line? We live in a digital world. The era of cross lines is over.
Well, you tell me. You're the technical guy. Okay. So what are we doing? There is some description for what we're doing here. You called it a sort of something end to end or something.
Well, I was going to use the professional term tape sync, which is where two people wish to interview each other over a long distance.
Right.
And the only way to do it without this person going to a studio is to have two people separately recording their own end of the conversation. So you're recording your end and I'm recording my end.
Yes.
And then they're synchronized in the final moment.
Indeed.
But I was going to... I say that's a professional term. That the opening there was a bit... I wouldn't say unprofessional, but it's it was a bit wonky. It took me aback.
Good. Well, that's all right. So we've both got Zoom recorders. I've got a sort of black Zoom recorder, and you're recording into yours. So if we can't put the phone on speaker, can we? Because then that's going to create sort of issues, some sort of feedback.
You could do it. It would create phasing, though. It would create strange effects
synchronised. We won't do that, then. Okay. Well,
this is your first wavelength where you've actually tried this technique, isn't it?
It is indeed. That's right, yes. I think I did one with Bob Parks where... That was just recording from the phone, but we didn't record separately. So in theory, you will then, I will then send you my recording, and you, you will sort of blend the two. And is that, that's a way of increasing the quality? Because I think
I forgot. We need a point of synchronization. So we should click. I should go, and you, and
well, how should I go then?
No, you should put the phone closer to the Zoom so I can hear my own click, and then I can synchronize.
So shall I put it closer to the Zoom now?
Yeah, yeah. Have a go now.
Okay.
That should do it.
All right. So I don't need to do the same thing. No.
No, you could do. I could just put my phone near it, but it's a bit demeaning for you.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. All right. Now, I'm in central London. I'm on the 14th floor of a block of flats in EC1, sort of near to Old Street. If I look out of the window, if I look south, I can see St. Paul's Cathedral. And I can, if I stick my head out the window, I can see the Shard and the Barbican. And if I look northwest, I can see in the distance, I can see St. Pancras. Now, you are in Bishop Stortford.
I am.
Right.
Which isn't that far from London, really. It's only 50 miles. But,
is it 50 miles?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, normally these tape sinks, as we call them, are reserved to when you want to interview someone on the other side of the world, in Canada or Australia, for instance. But due to the lockdown, obviously, we're each quarantined in our own spaces at the
moment. So we haven't seen each other for at least 3 months. So we're both sort of, well, semi-confined. I think you are more confined than I am, because I've actually been going to the bookshop most days, where I can sort of lock myself into the bookshop. And
Well, that's a nice space that's opposite the Tate Modern. The river nearby.
Exactly.
And it's like a little. It's like an oasis of.
It feels quite safe once you get in. I mean, to be going there with Sandra, in fact, who is in my household, so we're not contravening any bylaws there. And we will both go.
Are you worried when it opens? Are you worried about when it reopens?
Well, the shop at the moment is due to open on Wednesday, the 24th of June. And we're going to be opening Wednesday to Saturday, just 12 until 4, for 4 days a week, as it were.
Yeah.
And today we were there, and we just had delivery of one of these Perspex screens. So we've got an acrylic screen type thing, which sits on the counter.
You're kind of sealed in your own little cubicle.
Yeah, to some extent, yeah. Although, funnily enough, we had somebody had phoned up. He contacted us by email, first of all, and he wanted to buy a book on Salvador Dali. I mean, I should say that we do art books, you know, which is all, so on. It's called Marcus Campbell Art Books. So this chap wanted to buy, he said, have we got anything on Salvador Dali? We quoted him 4 books, and we had this massive thing which cost £80 by Robert Deschan.
And should you be mentioning this? There's customer confidentiality.
No, it doesn't matter. That's fine. So he said yes, that's fine. He said he'd been to Barcelona and wanted what he called a coffee table book to give to somebody all about Salvador Dali. So this fitted the bill. So he came along. He actually works in Fenchurch Street, EC3, in the city, but he hasn't been there for 3 months. So he walked. He walked from Putney along the embankment. To come and pay for this book today. So he arrived today between 12 and 2, bought this massive book on Salvador Dali. But you started by saying, am I worried? And I must admit, he was quite sort of casual in a way. I found myself worrying about everything he was touching.
So was he wearing a mask or gloves?
No, he wasn't wearing a mask or gloves. And he said he was sort of nearing retirement age. So he's sort of that age.
Living close to the...
Well, kind of, you know what I mean? So he was over that age limit where you were slightly more at risk than at any other time. But no, he didn't have a mask, he didn't have gloves, but he came in and, of course, he handled things. He put his backpack down sort of on top of this Perspex box that we have. And I found Sandra and myself, it was almost every step of the way we found ourselves thinking, Oh, he's done that now. Oh, dear. Oh, now he's doing this. Oh, now he's going to put his credit card into the machine. Oh, what are we going to have to clean now? You know, it was all like that. So this is the first person we've had in the shop since.
Have you got enough antibacterial wipes?
We have got a box of rubber latex gloves. We've got this Perspex screen. We've got the alcoholic hand gel. We've got wipes and we've got a bacterial spray. So
this whole thing makes you think how lucky we were. We took it for granted in the normal times when you could just buy a book without having all this worry.
Exactly. And so this we look, you know, as soon as he'd gone, and I was almost, you know, I'm sort of stepping backwards away from him as he's speaking because I didn't want to get too close. After he'd gone, we're then thinking, oh, we're going to have to wipe the door handles now. We're going to have to do this. He touched the credit card terminal. We'll have to wipe that with this cloth and so on and so on. Yeah. So, yeah, no, the whole thing is entirely neurotic.
Absurd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bizarre. What do you think? Do you think I'm being over neurotic about
it? Well, I don't want to spout any science thing. I was going to talk about the length of time viruses lay on things, but The Marcus Campbell bookshop is a safe place. It's got nice windows all the way around it, plenty of ultraviolet, which, as you know, suns the books regularly. And you have to change the stock in the window every so often to stop the red books especially becoming sunned.
Right, yeah.
And the Marcus Campbell sign itself is sunned slightly. The red has gone slightly. So that's a good sign. That's actually a sign that the ultraviolet is present.
Right.
And it would kill any nasties.
Would it? You sound confident about this. You're suggesting.
Well, I don't want to be like.
I mean, ultraviolet rays, sort of, that have been on the books for the last 3 months aren't going to help, are they?
But after he's touched the book and some rays hit the book within an hour or so, that supposedly the book is less virusy than it would be if there were no ultraviolet rays.
Right. Okay. Hmm. Okay.
We must sound, you know, anyone listening to this must think we're just amateurs speculating.
Well, no, I mean, there's so much conflicting information, you know, today is the day when, of course, the non-essential shops have all been open. So everyone's being encouraged to queue to get into Primark and rush in.
To get non-essential things.
Exactly. Go on.
I was about to say, I don't want to disparage your bookshop, but there is a stereotype among certain bookshops, more antiquarian, that people aren't really that welcome in the shop anyway. In the
in
best
bookshops?
Yeah, not your one, but generally.
Right.
There's an antiquarian, there's like an antiquarian tradition, isn't there?
Well, as you probably know, being a bibliophile yourself or a bibliomaniac or whatever one wants to call it, bookshops do tend to attract people who do want to spend time just browsing. They can be almost like drop-ins for
you know, but that's the customers. I'm thinking about the owners and the people that work there. There was one shop, for instance, where I walked in and I said, "Where's the music section?" I said hello and everything, and he said, "The music section is just around the corner, second shelf on the left, and I think you'll find the CCTV cameras are there and there."
Right.
And I thought, stealing something.
Yeah, but you would not get that response in any other kind of shop, would you? Not even a record shop or a charity shop or anything. It's bookshops.
No.
And it's because I think... Isn't there a... I mean, I think it is fair to say that... perhaps it isn't fair to say, but bookshops are targets for thieves. I mean, there is a sort of market in second-hand books where...
I think electronic shops are much more like Maplin's, the late Maplin's. That was more targeted than a bookshop, surely.
Do you think so?
I just think books would be so hard to sell. It takes much longer to sell a book than it would do a piece of electronics or a DVD even.
Yeah. Well, I do. I remember there used to be a bookshop on Museum Street, and it was run by Ballantyne and Date and Bob Date, who's died now. But I remember he said to me once that he found it dispiriting or something. It put him off being in the book trade. The fact that he had to watch people like a hawk, You know, they'd had so many books had gone missing from the shop. In the end, he found it depressing that he had to regard people in that way, that he was like watching people to see, you know, because they knew it happened. And so that gives you, it gives you a different approach to people.
There was a story that you had of a guy that just tore the first pages out from books for some reason.
That's right, yes, yes. Peter Jolliffe in Ulysses, which used to be on Museum Street, he said a guy would regularly come in there, and they had very valuable modern first editions. And he said he knew who was doing it. He recognised, you know, the man would come in, and he knew that this guy was doing it. But he apparently, Peter Jolliffe was just too timid or too frightened of the man to do anything about it. And so this guy would tear out the first page or the front end paper or something, which of course makes a modern first edition, you know, like a tenth of the value because people.
Yeah.
Don't, you know.
And then would he have an accomplice that would then try to buy the book and point out the damage?
No, I don't know. We don't know. It was just some sort of strange behaviour, some sort of maniacal kind of.
Like a power trip, maybe.
It was probably revenge or something. He's probably resented the price of the book or something. So anyway, so there is a degree of, obviously there's a degree of nervousness about the coming situation, the opening up of the shop to potential customers. But I suppose we'll just have to get on with it, you know.
I suppose it would have to be, would the Tate Gallery open as well?
Well, the Tate Gallery is rumoured to possibly be opening in August. Maybe mid-August, but that will attract, or in the past that has attracted sort of, you might get a parade of tourists who come in and just sort of, you know, there's a lot of people who just want to go into a bookshop and while away half an hour with no intention.
Yeah, it all adds to the atmosphere of the bookshop, though, doesn't it? And I think that actually draws more people in. The more people in the bookshop tends to create more sales, wouldn't it? I think logically that would do you not think so?
That's a sort of romantic view of it. That's you seeing it as a customer. Yeah, you're somebody that frequents bookshops. But if you've spent many days and weeks, if not years, behind the counter of a bookshop, you might view it differently. But I don't want to sound too cynical, but.
No. Well, yeah, if there's any trade to be cynical in, it's the book trade.
Right.
But I think that it's interesting what you're saying about the state of the trade under this condition, how this pandemic is affecting the book trade. I think that's an interesting cultural bubble that's quite vulnerable to these distortions of behaviour.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I mean, I've walked down Cecil Court and up Charing Cross Road fairly recently.
Is anything open?
No, they're all closed. But I mean, Cecil Court, as you know, I mean, I don't know if people listening, they might not be aware of it. Cecil Court runs between St Martin's Lane and Charing Cross Road, and it's all bookshops. And
it's very popular with Harry Potter tourists because it's a filming location for one of the films.
Right, yes, yes. It's like a bit of old London, isn't it? And so there's probably 20, at least 20 bookshops on that court. It's like a pedestrian alleyway, precinct, whatever you want to call it. And I think it's written into the lease. The story is that whoever owns the freehold or the leases or whatever, they are obliged to keep it as a book street. It has to stay as bookshops.
Well, there's a few shops that aren't bookshops. Like,
well,
there's an auction house there.
An auction house, yeah, but that sort of sells books. And then you've got print shops which sell pages from, you know what I mean? There is a bit of leeway there. You could call it printed matter or something, printed paper, vendors. Mm. There's that famous, the occult bookshop, Watkins is down there. You had the theatre bookshop, which you used to go to quite a lot.
Oh, Pleasures of Past Times.
Pleasures of Past Times, which was a theatre bookshop for decades and then was taken over by The Sun. He's just a... But
that was a great shop.
Yeah, and he's left now. That shop is empty. But I suppose the point I'm making is that there's a street which was, in theory, has to be bookshops. But yeah. we both know for a fact that some of those shops have almost given up anyway, because Peter Ellis, for example, he was due to leave in March of this year because he'd been there for years, but there isn't enough trade. You know, it's difficult running to run a secondhand bookshop at a profit unless you own the premises or something. And I know he was going to leave, but I've actually been bumping into him in the Aldwych post office, and his trade has gone up because he's doing the internet. Well, he's always done the internet, but he's selling far more on the internet now than he was in the past. But that's no justification. That's no reason to have a shop.
I suppose not, but does it encourage him to hold on to the lease? If he's making some profit online,
yeah,
he could. I mean, it's nice to have a bricks and mortar shop.
Well, it is, yeah. But that's what people say. But that obviously, of course, it's nice. I mean, bookshops are nice little havens, aren't they?
And for someone like me, who's a collector, really, it's the place to go to find things you didn't know that existed,
right?
New discoveries.
Yeah.
Without bookshops, it would be. I don't know. You're less inclined to just browse stock on the internet.
But the Charing Cross Road was also supposed to be all bookshops. I mean, there was Zwemer's there, but they've one by one, they've all kind of given up.
And even Quinto's is now.
There was a guy called Ian Shipley who had a bookshop there, who used to do art books on the Charing Cross Road, and he sort of tried to start this sort of campaign to keep the Charing Cross Road as bookshops, but he gave up in the end. I think he inherited a fortune and went to live in Gibraltar. But that shop closed. You've still got any amount of books, Pordes. Did you say Quinto's? What's happening with
Quinto's? It's shut down, but it's hopeful because the shelves are still up. They haven't. Well, last time I was in London, anyway, they haven't. Right. By the look of it, maybe you could have a look in and see.
Yes, but I will.
I'm hoping that that's a temporary blip.
Yeah,
and maybe that would survive because that's
good shop. But this could be the whatever you call it, the death knell of the bookshop trade in that way, because or maybe not. Perhaps I'm being over dramatic, but
well, they've been saying that. They said that about the Kindle when the Kindle came out. That was the death knell,
right? Yeah, but
actually, that encourages people to seek the original editions, because often they find a book to download and they actually want the original physical copy as well. So maybe that helped a bit.
Yeah, but normally you would normally spend a lot of time in the British Library, wouldn't you?
Yes, I'd be doing all kinds of research into obsolete histories, as I call them, or fouled histories.
Yeah.
Histories which haven't been written about before. And these are discovered mainly by looking through self-published books, books that have evaded Google's all-encompassing digitization project.
Right.
So these are books that are offline, off the radar.
Yeah.
And I'd investigate these at the library and publish my findings. I've done a book called The Magnetic Music of the Spiritual World, but that was self-published. I'm still looking for a publisher. I mean, I'm amazed, actually, that no publisher's taken this up, because it's an alternative history of pre-electronic music that brings to light many things that have never been discussed before in any study of electronic sound. But, there's lots of other aspects of self-publishing I'm interested in, and the library is planning on reopening next month.
Is it really?
Which would be interesting.
Oh wow! Yeah. Okay. What? So in July, the British Library will be open. That's interesting. Gosh,
I've got no idea of how the logistics would work in the reading rooms. And things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. I suppose
maybe
it's going to be much easier there for them to do that quarantining business because the books get called up anyway, don't they? You know what I mean?
The seating will be a bit weird. Maybe the seating will be every other seat would be a no-go area. They'll take away the seats every other seat.
Right.
But I don't know.
So you know for a fact that it's going to reopen in July?
Well, I've been told that was the plan.
Maybe
the July is just for the administrative side. Maybe that's just the workers. I don't know if it's actually open to the public.
Yeah.
Would that encourage you?
Would you then feel okay to travel on public transport into London to go to the British Library?
I don't think it's worth it. Just to. I've got no idea whether what I'm doing is frivolous, which some people say it is, or if it's my only vocation. It's all I can do, really.
Well, it's serious research, isn't it? I mean, it's...
It is, but I get... I'm like a zombie. There's a poem, I think, by Louis MacNeice called The British Museum Reading Rooms.
Oh, yeah.
And it talks about the scholars, like upside-down bats in the reading room, contemplating their doom.
Well, that's tricky. I don't know what to say about that, really.
Anyway, I'm on the show to promote something. Which is...
What's the first I've heard of it? Hang on a minute. No promotions on this show. Is this an advert? I'm sorry, we'll have to cut you off. You're trying to sneak in an advertisement. You never mentioned promotion when we agreed to
do this
program.
I'm going to force it an advert.
You're going to what?
What was that?
The new Oscillatorial Binage album is out now. Agitations, Post-Electronic Sounds is a CD and booklet release presenting a new form of post-electronic sound making, an album of explorations upon bin-scrounged objects built into assemblies subjected to electromagnetic force fields. The resulting harmonies offer a rich, immersive, microtonal musical experience. Agitations, Post-Electronic Sounds is available to buy now on Sub Rosa Records.
Right. Okay, so when does the advert start?
Well, that's the advert.
That's more like it's more like aversion therapy.
No.
No, I'm kidding. No, it sounds fine.
So That was an exclusive outtake from an Oscillatory Binage track from the new album Agitations Post-Electronic Sounds on Sub Rosa Records by Oscillatory Binage. And the reason I wanted to play that was because it involves found objects that were found in bins, bin diving.
Yeah.
Finding objects to make sounds with is obviously not possible at the moment. There's nothing in bins.
Yeah.
It's a pandemic. There's nothing in bins at the moment worth taking. So the next thing along is ground diving.
Right.
Looking in the ground for rocks across forests, shrubland, and even excavated quarries and like places like that. And I've actually been doing this recently, going on long walks in Bishop Stortford and going on to some kind of archaeological dig type site, right. An abandoned quarry type area.
Yes. So I think you've been... So, well, Bishop Stortford, for someone that's never been there before, just give us a bit of a sketch of the terrain.
Geologically or
what's the house like you live in? Is it semi-detached? Is it a mansion?
It's a semi-detached house,
right?
On a suburban cul-de-sac.
Does it have pebble dash?
What's that?
When the front of the house looks like it's got pebbles stuck in concrete.
No. It's a brick. It's a modern sort of 1960s brick built. Ex-council house, really. It's,
right.
Yeah.
And you live on it, so it's a street, a sort of suburban street, or...?
Yeah, very suburban street. To the credit of the architect, he did try to interlace bungalows with massive, like, seven-room mansions, really, so to create a kind of social hodgepodge of, of, you know, to try to mix things up a bit. So it was an interesting project, but the end result is a kind of middle brow, ubiquity really everywhere.
Is it tree lined? Does it have hedges?
It was. I mean, we've got hedges and I've got two trees, but they're always we always get letters saying you have to chop this down. The roots are interfering with the water supply.
Right.
And where once there were many trees on this street, they've all been chopped down now. So there's very little.
Right. And less grass. How far are you from the centre of Bishop Stortford?
Oh, just a 5-minute walk.
Oh, really?
Walk, I
suppose. Oh, okay. So you can walk into the centre of Bishop Stortford. And what's that?
Well, I can walk 10 minutes to the station. I just walk to the station. The station's kind of in the centre, so
And is that sort of like shopping malls and stuff? And
There's a kind of parade called Jackson Square, which is a kind of mall type thing. But then there's small shops and things like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And so you go for walks. You can walk into what's relative countryside or not, or is it just a sort of...
Well, whenever I used to leave the house, I'd always turn right, which would lead me into the town centre, to the station, to where things are happening. And I've never actually turned left in the last 10 or 20 years.
Gosh.
Because left goes nowhere. That just goes out to countryside.
Right.
So in the last month or so during lockdown, I've been turning left as I leave the house to just re-explore areas that have never been explored for 10 or 20 years. Forests, school playing fields, shortcuts across shrubland, and a lot of it's changed, and a lot of the other environments have very peculiar memory nuggets of nostalgia to revisit these places after so long. It's quite an unusual experience. They look smaller usually than they should do.
Well, that's interesting. So basically, that's during this phase then, during this the last 8 or 10 weeks, you've been not forced, but you've found yourself going into areas that you wouldn't normally have gone into, and they are sort of nostalgic.
Yeah, and part of this is to do with my exercise routine, which I'm quite anti-exercise, really. I've never liked the rhythm and the kind of militarism of exercise, the left-right, up-down. I prefer to... create a more chaotic form of exercise,
right?
Which involves galloping sideways, flapping the hands, really just using environmental cues to exercise. Exercise doesn't have to be rigid. It doesn't have to be regimented and timed and
so do you,
you know, a competition.
Would you gallop sideways when you're sort of out on the street then?
Not in public view, but I'd find secluded areas where I could do that, like fields and so on.
Right.
And it's not just exercise of the body, it's exercise of the voice.
Yeah.
You can just vocalise Zoe Ball and or you like Jamie Theakston.
So you shout these words out. You call out Zoe Ball and Jamie Theakston whilst galloping sideways.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just one example. Yeah.
Why Zoe Ball and Jamie Theakston?
They're random. I mean, it's all to do with environmental cues, anything on the spur of the moment that you'd like to vocalise.
Yes.
Do it. It's an action, and an action is an exercise.
Right.
So it's worth doing.
Yes. So,
obviously,
so this is you.
Can I just add a wait. I just added a disclaimer so I don't seem crazy.
Too late. All right. So you turn left and you wander into the countryside, down memory lane, passing your old school. Galloping sideways and shouting Zoe Ball to nobody in particular. And but you mentioned something about an archaeological dig, which is close by.
Well, I assume it's an archaeological dig. There's an area of field that's been earmarked for development.
Mm.
But obviously, because of the lockdown, the development's been suspended. But I think prior to the development, there's some kind of archaeological custom of just digging up the ground to see what's there.
Yeah.
And there's evidence of trenches being dug and various tags of an archaeological nature.
Yeah.
And that's all been abandoned. Anyway, the point is, I found this site by chance because a public footpath straddles the two fields.
Yeah.
So this field has exposed the geology of the area. Hertfordshire has notoriously lots of flint. Every other stone is flint, basically. It's a very common stone here. And you find these fossil sponges, which are often encased in flint, creating hollow flints. And this is, in a roundabout way, coming to what I was describing about ground diving. I'm finding interesting sound-making objects in the ground.
Right.
These 500-million-year-old fossil sponges are instruments, really. They've got resonant frequencies.
Right.
These hollow stones can be blown.
Uh-huh.
And I've got some here. I can demonstrate to you if you'd like to hear them.
How many have you got? How many do you have in your...
I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, and I haven't cleaned out the other several others as well. They've got their mud gets inside, you see, and you need a piece of wire to clean out the channels.
Right. Okay. All right. Let's hear them then.
This is a flint whistle. Hang on.
Ah. Right.
So this is the first flint whistle.
Yeah.
It's a tube with some holes.
It's sort of a bit like a sort of Stone Age harmonica.
A Stone Age ocarina, or
okay.
stone flute, as they're called. They have just a stone with holes in it.
Yeah.
Presumably the sponges that have left their cavities in the flint. And then there's this panpipe flint, which terminates in a cavity.
Oh, yeah.
Two holes which don't link up.
Yes.
Ha ha ha! It's shaped like a telephone.
Right.
And I call it the telephone rock.
Yeah.
And then there's the gun rock, which is shaped like a gun, which just has one channel all the way through the barrel.
Right.
Got no tone to it, really. But
right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So those are some hollow flints. But the point is, you can attach a feedback system to them. Oh. So they can have a microphone and a small loudspeaker inside them. And you can then access the different notes through feedback.
Right. Can you demonstrate that, or is it not?
I can.
Okay.
It sounds like this.
So you go and sort of basically spoil this archaeological dig by sort of...
I'm not spoiling it. It's over.
It sounds like it's only half finished and you're pillaging it. It's a sort of... probably some priceless Roman artefacts there or something.
Well, I've actually been finding Roman pottery.
Ah.
It's very distinctive.
Finding? There's a name for this, isn't there? What do they call
that? It's just on the site. It's on the soil. It's ground diving. It's like in the ground. I mean, what if you take coal out of the ground?
Right.
Who does the coal belong to? I mean, what?
Yeah. But what's the name for that stuff when people find, what's it, trove or something? It almost belongs to the state, doesn't it?
Well, are people going to take my rocks away?
I don't think anyone wants the rocks, but anyway.
Well, they might be instruments. Some of them have actual markings near the holes, almost as if they were used as musical instruments.
Right. Well, there we are. Sort of, yeah.
Well, this has made me discover that there's three ways of getting sounds from rocks.
Right.
That's one of them, just blowing into the hollow rocks. There's also hitting them, the obvious one, just with a xylophone, different, and they sound like this. I can play you those.
Okay.
So let me...
Yeah. Very subtle.
They haven't got much decay to them. They're not resonant things,
right.
But they do have a tone, and they're quite big rocks, right. Actually. They sound like tinkly small things, but
yeah.
They're quite big, chunky rocks.
So is this time for... I mean, I hardly dare say it, but of course, is this rock music?
Oh, that pun has been done by the Richardson Rock Band in 1810. that already exists.
Right.
It wasn't a pun in 1810.
No,
it was,
no.
But the Richardson Rock Band was a thing. It existed, and it's been rediscovered by me among...
What is that? Tell me more about that. What's that?
the Richardson Rock Band was just a family who lived near a quarry, and they built a xylophone from found rocks.
Right.
And they became quite popular on the entertainment circuit.
Gosh.
Playing their rock xylophone. It was called the Rock Band, and there's these nice...
When was this?
1810.
God, right, okay. Yeah. Very avant-garde.
Yeah. Well, they were playing musical standards on it. They were playing, like...
Yeah.
But anyway, I was getting back to the three different ways of making music from rocks. That's one way, hitting them, blowing into them. And I discovered, whilst washing the rocks, that they whistle and sing to you while you wash them.
Right.
If you don't believe me, I have the recording.
Okay.
So I tried to build a post-electronic means of sustaining this fizzy whistle. So I built a small tap, and if I turn the tap slightly, you can hear the whistling limestone. It sounds like this. That's one of them.
Well, that's quite impressive. I can hardly hear it, but there is a definite sort of there's something going on there.
Well, it's a fizzy kind of whistling. There's not much bass to it, but I suppose you could add bass. It's very electronic sounding.
So how is that being created? I couldn't really.
I think it's because the limestone is so dry. As soon as you introduce cold water to it, there's some change in temperature. And limestone is also very reactive anyway. I mean, you add vinegar to it, it will fizz violently. So it's a very reactive stone, and I think it's just air escaping.
Right,
and
right.
The bubbles create these tones, very so electronic
sort of
sounding.
Kind of creaking, almost.
Creaking, popping, all kinds of tones, really. I mean, you've got a ready-made synthesizer at your disposal. I mean, who needs a £1,000 Moog when you've got a rock of limestone and right. some water and a small tap?
Yes. So this would only have come about during this period. I mean, this is sort of literally kind of your lockdown music, I suppose.
Yes. In normal circumstances, I would be still using the electromagnetism on found objects. And this is a kind of... I've been pushed into a different sphere,
right,
as it were,
right.
Reduced to foraging in the ground,
right.
Or when I say reduced, I mean possibly even ascended. Maybe it's the next level. Maybe it's being much closer to the earth is a good thing, rather than
so. This you could call it. You could call it rock down music.
Rock down music.
Because it's going down, and you're sort of it's instead of.
Well, that was a misnomer. What's the word?
Misnomer.
Yeah, that was a figure of speech. I should have said we've ascended to this level. This is actually something that's been, I think, it's much purer than looking in a bin and just doing something with a piece of consumerist overspill.
Yeah,
like a wok or something that's been overproduced by our wasteful culture. This is actually maybe how it should always have been, music from the ground.
Right. You've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and I've been talking to Dan Wilson with his, what do we call it, Dan? A sort of branch of geology almost, geological rockdown music.
Ground rockdown, I quite like that. But it's also a bit too guitar-y. It comes as images of guitars.
Yes,
actually,
that's
true. I've just got stones, water,
right.
And tissue. Well,
if I think of anything else, I'll get back to you.
Maybe I'll end the show with a
you could play
a piece
some
of rock music.
Rock music, yes, exactly.
9 o'clock. I had a slight headache, but I got rid of it. Marta came to breakfast with me. I did a little shopping, and then I came home. I put all the letters in the yellow bag, and I was going to... What? Very strong. Honestly, I have lots and lots of courage. After that, I got dressed. Marta came to pick me up, and here I am. I just came from her house. And she's been perfect, really good, perfect. Yes, she seems to be like that, but she really is. You were right, as usual. The red dress with the fur. My black hat. Yes. I still have my hat on. No. I'm not smoking. Only 3 cigarettes so far.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance FM. If you like what you heard, please support our work by making a donation at resonancefm.com/donate.